This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was 13-term United States Congressman Louis Gutierrez of the 4th District, representing the southwest and northwest sides of the city of Chicago. Congressman Gutierrez is the senior member of the Illinois delegation in Congress and a member of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. He addressed three subjects: Puerto Rico, immigration, and President Trump. Regarding President Trump, he said, "The Republicans will not really investigate their president. They have not held one hearing in the Judiciary Committee or the Senate Committee dealing with those possibilities of investigating the president." Then his bombshell: articles of impeachment will be filed against President Trump by a group of members of the House before Thanksgiving. He said that President Trump is simply unfit to be president of the United States, not because he's a Republican, but according to Congressman Gutierrez, because he's vindictive, partisan, and does not understand the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the democratic process. With regard to Puerto Rico, he said the response of the American government is disgraceful. He says we simply cannot trust, and he will not support a budget unless there are guarantees of visas for the 800,000 Dreamers.
Thank you, Jay, for the wonderful introductions here this morning and for convening this breakfast. It's wonderful to be home in Chicago, and it's wonderful to be with so many dear friends here this morning. I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about Puerto Rico. I'm going to talk about immigration. And lastly, I'm going to talk about Donald Trump. In that order. First, I do want to say thank you. When I visited Puerto Rico, it became clear to me that the response of the American government, which should be distinguished from the response of the American people, is disgraceful. It's unacceptable, and it's almost un-American, the way we are treating 3.4 million people that live on the island of Puerto Rico. And why do I say that? Because we have the ability to set up that electrical grid in a much quicker fashion. We just don't have, I won't say, but you get my point. We could have set up satellites. We can send hundreds of thousands of American soldiers thousands of miles across, and we could set up communication systems, and all those soldiers speak to one another. And you're telling me we couldn't set up a communication system on the island of Puerto Rico? 6 weeks later, they said half the cell phone service is up. We can do it. I've seen it. You're telling me that dozens of bridges that were washed out, gone, eliminated, we could not have put those bridges back? I've seen it. You've seen the videos. You've seen what we were able to do. You're telling me that we could invade Normandy, we can cross all the way to Paris, France, and we can rebuild, and Germans were shooting at us. We could do all of that, and we, as of today, we have not restored one single bridge on the island of Puerto Rico? No. We could do so much more. And it's not about calling for a state of siege in Puerto Rico where the military takes over. No, we're the military, right? The best trained, most highly equipped military in the world is not being used in order to make sure that the people of Puerto Rico are. So I was there last weekend, and I have to tell you, it just broke my heart. It just broke my heart to see so many weeks later. I'm going to give you one anecdote. We met a woman in Loíza. Now, Loíza is a very Afrocentric part of the island of Puerto Rico. And it just seems to me, and I have to say this, that the darker you are as a Puerto Rican in terms of your complexion, the more severe the consequences of the hurricane. And that's not an indictment of Puerto Rican society. It's just a fact. So I went to Loíza. And there was a woman crying, asking me, Congressman Gutierrez, and showing me her adult son with severe disabilities, just severe disability, sitting on a bench. And you know where he was sleeping? He was sleeping on a wet mattress. with no real roof over his head. And she begged us to bring us back a mattress. And I want to say to the people of Chicago, thank you for contributing so much of the funds. You know what we did that day? We went back to Sam's Club. Yep, Walmart. And we bought that boy a mattress. And he couldn't speak. And he really couldn't move. But I got to tell you, he moved and he smiled. And it left on me just the impression that I will never forget. One human being, one young boy, got a mattress. Why aren't we putting tens of thousands of cots? Hundreds of thousands of mattresses are gone. That's what happens in a hurricane. 500,000 people in Puerto Rico today are still homeless. And an electrical grid? You mean we had to go all the way to Whitefish, Montana? The hometown of Zinke, the interior secretary. Of course, that had nothing to do with it. And then we employed a company to reestablish the energy grid in Puerto Rico that 2 weeks ago had two employees, whose largest contract was $1.2 million. And we found them because they were the best and the finest and gave them a $300 million contract. Now, I got to tell you something, and please tell your children that Congressman Gutierrez repeated it here this morning. What you put on Facebook stays there forever. And so all we did was a simple search of Facebook, and guess what? There we found the owner of Whitefish at the inaugural of Donald Trump and his wife with Secretary Carson of Health and Human Services. And then we went and checked the FEC reports, and there were the hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign. Look, I get it that somebody friendly to a mayor might get the Starbucks concession at the airport. That somebody friendly with the governor gets, you know, all of a sudden the paving contract. I get it. It's wrong. It's wrong. But you know what? This is deadly. This is deadly. This goes beyond that. This is criminal. How do children get their refrigeration so that they can have their baby formula without electricity? I mean, think about it. There are tens of thousands of people in Puerto Rico that need insulin. Insulin needs refrigeration. You are putting their lives at stake when you commit such an act. I mean, how do you get it? What about the woman with cancer that needs to go into the hospital so that she can continue to get her cancer treatment? Hospitals are still running on generators in Puerto Rico. Yes, on generators. I know they're going to tell you 20% of the electrical grid is up. It's up for a little while. But while I was there, San Juan went down twice. And every time it goes down, it puts enormous pressure on those generators at those hospitals. And sooner or later, they will fail. They will fail. And when they fail, then you begin to see the greater point I'm trying to make here today. It is criminal to do and make such an act. I mean, everybody says, well, the water, guess what? You cannot supply people with water unless the pumps work, and the pumps do not work without electricity. You know what you get? You get a cross intersection of sewer and your water. Yes, your portable water. That's what you get. Damaging and contaminating all of the water system. I don't know if you've seen the picture of people going by the mountain sites and even into the rivers where there is poisonous water already and using it, because what do? This is week six. Thursday will be week six, and still hundreds of thousands of people. So I also want to say, though, everywhere I went, you know what everybody told me? They told me, say thank you to America. Say thank you to the American people. Because one mayor after another told me they have received more from you, the American people, than the government that we elected to represent us. So I want to say on their behalf, thank you to all of you for your enormous generosity. Because of you, many of them are getting food. Many of them are getting tarps. Many of them are getting mad. Many of them are getting back on their feet. Thank you, American people, for standing up with the people of Puerto Rico. And I don't Since I'm going to be talking about immigration, I just want to just segue quickly. And I want to say thank you to a very dear friend, a personal friend of mine, John Rowe, because he is such a great example of, civic Chicago and of America, in my opinion. He texted me. He said, Louise, what can I do? And I want to say thank you, John, for thinking about me in those terms and our relationship in those terms and for your incredible generosity. I want to tell you every last dollar that we have received at the Puerto Rican Agenda has been delivered there. And, I know people like to pick up crates and water and supplies, but most of that stuff that was picked up is still in a warehouse in Chicago. The way to do it these days is really to get cash. Because that allowed me to go to Sam's Club, yes, at Walmart, not one of my favorite companies in the past, but they've risen in my esteem. I called them and I said, we've got money, we just don't have a way to use that money. Well, they have large storage systems in Puerto Rico because of their Sam Clubs and their Walmart. They have a huge presence. And so they were very kind. And I want to thank all of the employees at Walmart and at Sam's Clubs because when I got there, the crates and the love that they demonstrated for us in getting out our relief effort was extraordinary. I didn't see them so much as Walmarts, but as patriots, ready to help their fellow Puerto Ricans. And it was wonderful to work with them. And if that causes me problems with some friends on the left, then so be it. But I want to say thank you to all of the wonderful people there because we took our cash and we bought stuff. Because it's really a question of distribution of those that have and those that, hurricanes and these natural disasters don't affect everybody equally. Some people not having electricity is inconvenient. Really is inconvenient. For other people, it's life and death. And so I have to say, we just have to do better. I'm going to demand that we do better because this is not right. We should not treat the people of Puerto Rico any differently than we're treating the people of Houston. They're all in hotels or in housing, and they're all been put in a safe place. We moved 90% of the population of New Orleans out of New Orleans. I mean, we did things. In Jacksonville today, there are people that are in housing, in decent housing. I read the New York Times and said, there's a big issue about what kind of housing we're going to put people in, what kind of temporary housing, and a big debate. There's no debate in Puerto Rico. There isn't any. Literally for hundreds of thousands of people. I want to reiterate that. Now, how do we rebuild Puerto Rico? I think we need to rebuild Puerto Rico by understanding one thing. Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. And with colonialism come responsibility. You cannot assert, and the Congress cannot assert, that it has the sovereignty of the people of Puerto Rico rests in the Congress of the United States without assuming the responsibility that comes with, quote, ownership of a people and an island. And with that, I simply say to you the following. If it belongs, if Puerto Rico belongs to but is not part of the United States, has been declared at the Supreme Court, we have a responsibility because they're American citizens. I mean, they say the $74 billion. Well, who the hell decided to pass legislation, if not the Congress of the United States, to allow the government of Puerto Rico to sell triple-exempt bonds? It wasn't a decision by the people of Puerto Rico to allow those triple-exempt bonds. It was a decision. What decision was it of the Congress of the United States, starting with Bill Clinton in 93, to eliminate Section 936 of the Internal Revenue Code, which creates jobs? Because it creates incentives for people to invest and bring their companies to Puerto Rico and put Puerto Ricans to work. And instead, what did they give us? More food stamps. That does not bring about self-reliance and a dignity and a self-respect to a people. Work and jobs should be the mantra for Puerto Rico. Let's invest there and let's bring companies there and put Puerto Ricans to work. And I'll show you a new island of Puerto Rico. And lastly, as we go about our energy grid, how could you be on a tropical island and not take advantage of the wind that enters Puerto Rico from the east every day, 365 days of the year, and you are not harvesting that wind? We don't do a single thing with the wind that comes through Puerto Rico. But wait a minute, I know you're all thinking, what about the sun? It rises practically every day with no clouds. I know some of you said, oh, last time I was on vacation, Gutierrez, it rained the 3 days I was there. I know you're thinking that, but you get my point, don't you? I mean, we should have the smallest carbon footprint of anywhere in the world on the island of Puerto Rico if we do it right. And I say we do it right this time. We create an energy grid, and because let me just tell you, climate change is going to knock it out again. And we have to stop building it on poles and start building it under the ground where it can be protected on a tropical island. We're going to spend billions of dollars redoing an electrical grid. What, so the next hurricane can come and knock it back out again? Doesn't make any sense. But in order to do that, Congress has to act, because what FEMA is going to do, it's going to restore it to the condition it was in as Maria visited us. Lastly, it is shameful that more people will die and more people will be hurt and harmed after Hurricane Maria than during the hurricane itself because of lack of proper response. So I am calling for a new pact of friendship. Friendship, yes, between the people of Puerto Rico and the United States of America. Because I trust the American people, although I may not trust the American government, which I serve. I think we can do that, and we can make Puerto Rico a special place. But in order to make it a special place, we have to give it the incentives so that it can create the jobs. And we need to lift the Jones Act. And I just want to tell you one last thing, because you have to understand this. I mean, I understand that if you're shipping something from Charlotte to Houston, okay, so you use the U.S. Merchant Marines. But guess what? If there's something in Charlotte, you can also transport it on a truck. You can transport it on rail. Or you can simply open a factory in Houston so you don't have to ship it at all. But as Donald Trump taught us, Puerto Rico is an island in the ocean, surrounded by water. And to impose the Jones Act on the people of Puerto Rico is deplorable. And it has been imposed since 1920, and you cannot strangle an economy by saying that the only way it can ship its goods in or out is by using the most expensive shipping in the world, which is the U.S. Merchant Marines. That's not right. That's not right. So stop strangling the island of Puerto Rico. Alleviate some of these vestiges of colonialism so that it can move forward and more independently and more proudly into the future. If you accumulate the cost to the consumer of the imposition of the Jones Act, which is about $400 to $500 million a year in extra cost to all the goods people in Puerto Rico have to pay. We can't use the Panamanian ship. Can't use a Chinese ship, can't use a Venezuelan ship, must be an American-made ship with an American crew. If you allow people of Puerto Rico to do what commerce and industry does everywhere else, then you will see that that competitive advantage will come to the people of Puerto Rico. That's the first thing I wanted to talk to you about my island of Puerto Rico and moving forward. I think she's going to, the last thing I'm going to have to tell you, I'm so proud. I've never been prouder of being Puerto Rican. I go to that airport and I take those planes and I see all these young men and women. They're the sons and daughters who have their parents back. And to watch them load generators and food and medicine and buy their moms and dads tickets to see that incredible love that they have. A couple of young men walked up to me and I said, so you're going to go get your dad? They said, my dad's going to die on that mountain in Calle Puerto Rico. He's going to die there. He'll never leave that mountain. I said, so what are you going to do? Well, we brought him a satellite phone, and we brought him a generator, and we brought him food. And we know my dad He'll die if we bring him to Chicago, more certainly than anything else. That's where he loves, and that's where we have to protect him. To see that kind of love and respect for your parents has just fills me with such pride and such joy. To see the Puerto Rican, a lot of people say, oh, the Puerto Ricans are coming, don't worry. They're all coming to their aunts and uncles' houses. They're all coming to their grandparents' houses. They're all coming to families' houses, because that's what Puerto Ricans do. We have a family, an extended family. But I do want to say to Rahm Emanuel, thank you for setting up the city of Chicago as a welcoming place for Puerto Ricans fleeing the island of Puerto Rico. I really want for setting up a school system and healthcare and transition systems in the city of Chicago. I think what a departure that is from when my dad and mom arrived here in Chicago in 1953. It was very, 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 very mean situation that they arrived here in Chicago in 1953, when separate but equal was still the law of the land, huh? When they faced discrimination, when they faced bigotry, when they faced all of the ills of a society. Guess what? Today we're welcoming them, right? Here at the City Club and throughout the city of Chicago. I like the America we live in so much better than the one I was born into. Let's make it even better tomorrow. Secondly, so we know that Donald Trump said the Mexicans are murderers, rapists, and drug dealers, and there's a few good ones, but most of them we have to get rid of. And he said that to begin his campaign. And if there is one thing that Donald Trump has been consistent about is his immigration policy, is the meanness of his immigration policy. Now, I want to make a couple of comments. First of all, the White House says that the border has never been more secure than it is today. They said they secured it at 80%. Well, the question should then come, if you have the border so secure, more secure than you've ever had it before, and it's 80% better today than it's ever been before, then why the hell do you need to build a fence and spend billions of dollars building a fence if the wall is so secure, if the border is so secure? I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't say you've done such a great job with security. And secondly, I want to make clear to everybody, because a lot of times this focus is a racist focus on our border between Mexico and the United States. And you can't sugarcoat it any other way. I don't like using the word. It's not a word that just simply comes right off of my lips. But it's the only way to describe it. We all know that there are millions of undocumented workers from all over the world that never crossed that border, but we never talk about them publicly from the White House. It is always the threat that exists, apparently, to the President of the United States between the border of Mexico and the United States. Let me tell you, more people will enter the United States today, overstay their visas, and become undocumented than cross that border. So if you want to talk about secure borders, let's start talking about LAX and O'Hare and JFK, and not simply the border between the United States of America and Mexico, because otherwise I'm going to call it for what it is. It is a vision of hatred, and it is a vision of division in the United States of America. And if any city knows the contribution that Mexicans and Latinos make to the greatness of the United States of America, it's the city of Chicago, where Latinos are remaking neighborhoods each and every day. And yes, I do feel a special responsibility to speak to those issues. Because if I don't do it, then who? It's going to be 30 years ago, that Harold Washington passed away. As mayor, he was mayor of the city of Chicago, to me, the greatest mayor of the city of Chicago. And there was a reason I believe he was the greatest mayor, because he allowed me and Jesus Garcia and so many others to obtain positions of influence and power. When we couldn't get elected, he hired us at City Hall. And he gave us responsibility that no other chief executive had ever given Latinos in the city of Chicago before. Latinos were always the assistant to the assistant to the assistant assistant to somebody. But in Harold Washington's administration, we had real power. We had real portfolios. And he gave us the opportunity to also do what else? To learn. To learn just how it is that government. And with that comes self-confidence. And with that comes, you know, information and knowledge that allows you to grow. So to me, and he opened up the doors for everybody, and he didn't discriminate against anybody. He didn't hold grudges and says, well, we didn't get stuff in the past, so it's time to make up. Nah, it wasn't Harold Washington. Harold Washington said, this is the standard we're going to set today, and it's a standard I can be proud of, we can all be proud of, and it's a standard which says everybody in the city of Chicago has the same right to live in a city in which services are rendered. So after 30 years, I just think it's what a difference. And I know that everybody thinks of Chicago as a sanctuary city. You know who started Chicago and said that in Chicago, the immigration services will not discriminate? Harold Washington in 1984 signed the first executive order, way before this became a vote, signed the first executive order saying, we will not cooperate with immigration services when it comes to the delivery of basic city services. And it was a Puerto Rican woman, Maria Zelda, who entering City Hall, who was part of Mayor Washington's cabinet, who was stopped by immigration agents and asked to identify herself, that caused the mayor to bring about this executive action. So I just want to say that I couldn't speak here today without saying thank you to Harold Washington, to his legacy, and to the fact that he was mayor of the city of Chicago, as I know we are all going to think about the 30th anniversary of his passing come this coming Thanksgiving. And the reason I bring it up is because, yes, I speak about it, because he taught me. I mean, he was such a great teacher because he would take time to sit down with me and other young Puerto Rican leaders and teach us. And one of the things he said to me, he says, Luis, remember, everybody has a base. Everybody has a base. If you're a woman, women are your base. I have an incredible base in the African-American community. You have one in the Latino community. But remember, Luis, you must always go beyond your base. You must always use that, right? And never forget them. Never forget them because they anchor you. But always remember that if you're going to be a great public servant, a good public servant, then you need to go beyond. So yes, this may have given me an opportunity, being Latino, to run in the 4th Congressional District. But I understand that there is a greater base. And that greater base to me is my immigrant community, whether they come from Ireland, whether they come from Jamaica, whether they come from Africa, Asia, they are all beloved to me, and they should be all beloved to everybody in this room. And we should never allow anybody to use bigotry and hatred against them. I'm going to stand up for immigrants in this country, regardless of the country they come from. And so let me just say this morning. 5 weeks ago, they now call them Nancy and Chuck. Nancy and Chuck got together with the president. Apparently they had a fantastic meeting because Nancy and Chuck came out of the meeting delirious with happiness as they had just met with the president of the United States and they had struck this deal. Of course, they threw 800,000 Dreamers under the bus in order to get to the deal, but they were happy and delirious about the deal. And I said to them, do you really trust Donald Trump? Do you really believe that a man who changes his position on the AM, at noon, and in the PM is going to keep part of this bargain with you? And do you really want to make a bargain with a man and not have stood up to the one gain we made under Barack Obama, which was his executive order, which freed 800,000 Dreamers from deportation, and you didn't say a word about them? Remember, the grand deal was made less than 24 hours after Donald Trump said that 800,000 Dreamers were going to lose their legality, their work permits, in 6 months. And here's what we did. We went and voted the Friday after the grand deal. And we raised the debt limit. I voted for it. And we extended a government funding for 3 months. I voted for it. And we also voted for hurricane relief for Texas and for Harvey. All those three things we did. Let me tell you what happened that day, just in case you didn't keep, you know, the score as you are in the World Series. 90 Republicans voted no on raising the debt ceiling. 90 Republicans voted no on keeping the government open and funded. 90 Republicans, including 4 from Texas, voted against relief for Texans because of Hurricane Harvey. Now, it just seems to me that if you're 240 strong, but 90 of your team abandon you periodically when it comes to issues of the budget and the debt ceiling, that is the point in which Democrats have to understand to use their leverage. Now, the budget's going to come due December the 9th. And here's what I'm saying. I want to vote for a budget on December the 9th. I want to keep the government open. I want to keep it functioning. I went to Congress not to destroy the government, but to strengthen it and to make it more efficient and to make it more humane and to make it a better place for all of us, make it more reliable and more respected by the American people. That's why I went to Congress. Now, if the Republicans propose a Republican budget come December 8th, to keep the government open, it's a Republican budget. Here's what I say. Then you find 218 Republican votes for it. You're the majority in the House. You're the majority in the Senate. It's a Republican budget. And then they're going to say, oh, Luis, you know we can't do that because we've got like 90 Republicans that'll never vote for a budget, never vote to raise the debt ceiling, even though that would cause catastrophic economic chaos across the world. And they're supposed to be the pro-business party. We'll get to that. But I vote to raise the debt ceiling and be serious and responsible about these things. So look, if they're going to have a Republican budget, then I say they find 218 votes. You need my vote? You need Democratic votes? Then I say we make sure that it's a budget that's reflective of our ideals, of our values, of our priorities, and then we vote for it. But if what you want is a Republican budget, then you find the 218 votes. And let me tell you something, they don't have the votes. They may be the majority on paper, numerically, but they don't have the unity in their party to raise the debt ceiling, to pass a budget. So if we know, how do I know that? You say, oh, Luis, how do you know that? Because I know. Because y'all know, because it's not really a big secret, because of the last 10 budgets, and you can check them. You know how they get passed? With a good number of Republicans and then a huge number of Democrats. Just check. Even though they've been in the majority. Even when George Bush was president of the United States. Which, by the way, I wish those days would come back. I know. Oh, my God. I thought you'd never hear me say something like that. So, you don't have 800,000 visas for the Dreamers, and we don't have the Dream Act, I'm not going to vote for that budget, because that budget does not represent my values, does not represent my ideals, does not represent my priorities. It's as simple as that. And to Democrats, they have to understand, we have to understand, that there are moments in which we define ourselves. And if Democrats vote for a budget and in collusion with Republicans do not free the Dreamers, then shame on us for not using our power, our influence, and our advantage at a strategic moment for our community. Because I have to say, I want to make sure that Democrats don't only stand up for immigrants during election time, but stand up for immigrants each and every day with their votes in the Congress of the United States. And I think this is a wonderful example of when we can do it. I want to talk about the last thing. President Trump. Now, I have to tell you that unlike Republicans during Watergate, the Republicans in the House and in the Senate are not going to use or fulfill their constitutional responsibility. More importantly, fulfill their constitutional responsibility. They're not. They're not going to investigate. They're not going to really look into the presidency of the United States of America and collusion between the Russians and a whole array and obstruction of justice and a whole array of other issues. They're not. We have tried. I'm a member of the Judiciary Committee. A lot of people said, you know, that's not that important a committee. Well, it is a pretty important committee if impeachment comes around, because it's the committee in which those processes start. And on the committee, we have attempted time and time again to fulfill our responsibility to hold accountable the executive government. We can't get them to hold a single, you haven't seen a single hearing in the House of Representatives and the Judiciary Committee. Not one. In the Senate, and you saw what happened in our Intelligence Committee, where my colleague, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said, I just figured out that President Barack Obama really did wiretap the phone of President Trump. Remember that? Remember that? Of course, Donald Trump told them, because he went to the White House the day before, and they whispered in his ear the secret evidence, and then he had this, remember that? I know I have this. I've just been briefed. Yeah, you were briefed by the President of the United States about that he was wiretapped. So that's the Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives. Totally discredited, right? Doing nothing. The Senate's doing a little bit, but not enough. And they're really investigators. So you know what? You know, I kind of like that guy, Mueller. You know, he's out there doing his job. And I have to say that, you know, our country and our democracy may count on that one man, and he's fulfilling his responsibility. And that wouldn't be the first time in American democracy that one person really makes such a huge difference. And I think yesterday was but the tip of the iceberg in terms of what is going to come forward. And I'm going to tell you that before Thanksgiving, a group of colleagues and I on the Judiciary Committee are going to file articles of impeachment against the President of the United States. I don't want anybody running out of here and think that Nancy Pelosi's behind it. Democratic Party's behind it. I'm telling you, and I want to repeat, I and a group of colleagues, some of which are members of the Judiciary Committee, will put those before the Congress of the United States. I think it is time that we began to have that conversation in the United States of America, because I do not believe that the President of the United States should be President of the United States of America, not because he's Republican, but because he's ill-fit for the office of the presidency of the United States of America. And now I just want to give you a little bit of political backdrop in terms of Donald Trump and what I hear. So when I hear him say, make America great again, here's what I think about. I think about when I was born in Chicago in 1953 in Lincoln Park neighborhood, not far from here. And I think about the fact that separate but equal was the law of the land. And there were certain swimming pools and parks. They may not have said Latinos and black people don't come here, but we knew better than to go there. That's the reality that I grew up in the city of Chicago, a very segregated city in which race and ethnicity played a huge part in my growing up. That's the past. That's the past. I mean, 1953, and that's why we want the attorney general that we have, because he's such a forward-thinking kind of guy. I mean, we have an attorney general who believes that, you know, women should still be in the kitchen and that gay people should be in the closet. Black people should be on the back of the bus. And me, I shouldn't even have the right to use this microphone. We've come such a long way since then in terms of how is it, in terms of our powers of integration and assimilation and just getting along, right? Isn't it? I mean, my grandson, Luis Andres, who's 14, he is so less burdened than I was, right? Because I grew up with all the bigotry and prejudice and everything else that was instilled in me and that I learned, that I had to get rid of. He doesn't have to grow up with that. And so I say, that was 1953. This is 2017. I like the fact that I go to the movie theater and this tall, very handsome man walks up to me and he says, "Hey, you're Congressman Gutierrez." I said, "Yes, I want to thank you. This is my partner, Brad. We're married. Thank you for standing up for our marriage." I like that America. I like that America. I like the America that's different than the America that my mom and that my wife grew up. I like the America better that my daughter lives in. Right? We fought for reproductive rights for women. We should guarantee the respect to reproductive rights of women in this country. We shouldn't turn back the clock. This is not 1953. You know, we all have a responsibility to those who came before us, especially those who sacrificed so that we could live better today, a more just, a more egalitarian society. I watched the civil rights movement. I watched the civil rights movement. I remember churches being bombed and burned. I remember the dogs being unleashed. I remember the brutality of the batons. I remember the assassination of Martin Luther King. I remember when he came to Chicago and he said, Martin Luther King said, "I have never seen such hatred anywhere in the United States as I have seen in Chicago. In Alabama or in Georgia," when he came here demanding access to housing. A lot of people gave up their lives. A lot of people sacrificed a lot so that I could use this microphone today and be a member of Congress and pass the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act so that I could live differently. And I'm going to defend all of the work and their lives and their blood and their sweat every day, because that's my responsibility to build upon it. So I know that I'm not just here all by myself. Millions of people have worked and have sacrificed so that I can be here. Let's all pay tribute to them each and every day, and how it is we live our lives, both at our places of business, in terms of our neighbors, and obviously in terms of those that we elect to public office. Thank you so much for having me here this morning.
Whoa. Thank you, Congressman Gutierrez. It's been an amazing, amazing morning for all of us and for the City Club. We really appreciate your being here. Well, you were here 2 years ago. You brought that buddy from Racine, Wisconsin.
Yes.
Mr. Ryan. And anytime you want to bring him back here to the city, we'll appreciate that. This is from City Club member Pete Kretikos. It's really an interesting question, sort of off the radar for a lot of us. The census. It seems that this administration is on the path of ensuring an undercount. What can or will Congress do to assure a full count?
The first thing we're going to do is we're going to do a marvelous job in 2018 in November, and we're going to take back the House of Representatives so that we can have a Congress that believes in a correct census. And I'm telling you, that's my answer. If you don't have power, there's not much you can do. You can complain. You can raise your voice, but you need to have power. And power comes through, I believe, in our electoral process and people participating. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue. There is a surge. I don't know if you've read the New York Times and Washington Post articles this week. There's a surge in applications for American citizenship. First time in the year after we elect a new president of the, because usually they wait just before we're going to elect the president. They, oh, the election's coming. And then people rush. They said, well, let me get ready and become American citizen so I can participate. And guess what happened this time? They elected a president. Now everybody's rushing to become an American citizen so they could be ready for the next time. That's true. It tells you a little bit. So I have been working on American citizenship and having a campaign since the very, very early stages of January of this year. And we're going to continue to do that. They're going to make it more difficult for us to help people become American citizens. They are. But guess what? They're ready to become American citizens. And what I'm going to tell you is the following. I remember in 1994, we had a questionnaire of who the governor of Illinois was, and Latinos couldn't tell who the governor of they couldn't. Yeah, we did a questionnaire. It was off the charts, right? It was like 7% answered it correctly, right? But you know what? 64% of them knew who the governor of California was, Pete Wilson. Now, why? Because there was a linkage between having to know, right, and your own personal life, right? Pete Wilson had Proposition 187, which said that we're going to stop any healthcare or education to undocumented, and made that proposition and put it on the ballot in California. And guess what happened? There was a surge of people becoming citizens of the United States, and they will forever remember who was the governor of California. So I think that's how we're going to do it. We need to increase the base, do voter registration, and do citizenship, and make sure that we do that. And I think we're going to have an excellent electorate the next time around that's going to make sure that we have a good count on the census.
Terrific. Thank you. We really have some interesting questions, and we'll try to get to a few if we can. This is from Nelson Rosario. He says, as a member of the Select Committee on Intelligence, what is your position on designating our election system as critical infrastructure?
It is critical infrastructure. And one of the things, look, my dad didn't go to, like, you know, graduate school or anything, right? He's a very smart man. And he used to always tell me, remember, son, the one with the most votes wins the election. And he passed away before watching this election. But that's not the way it works. So I think it is a critical. But what I think is we need to get away from the Electoral College. We should just say the popular vote is the popular vote. Whoever gets more Americans to vote for them should be president of the United States. We would have avoided... Look, I mean, yeah, for Democrats, is it? Yeah, it is. Okay, so you might say, well, Gutierrez is good for you. Yeah, Al Gore would be president of the United States. And so would Hillary Clinton. I mean, who gets the most votes should be president of the United States. That's the way we should do it. That's the way we elect Villegas to the city council, mayor, governor. Can you imagine we elected a governor that got 500,000 fewer votes than the other guy? We'd all go, why are we participating? So I think we need to change. And we should just go to the popular vote.
Okay. This is from City Club member Graham Grady with Taft Law. Are the prospects for achieving statehood for Puerto Rico improved in the wake of the hurricane?
Interesting question. So, first of all, I'm working with people in Puerto Rico regardless of their political or ideological affiliation. I think we need to put the restoration of our island and the health and the safety of our people ahead of ideological concerns about the future of Puerto Rico. I have always been an advocate for independence for Puerto Rico. Now, some people say that's anti-American. Furthest thing from the truth, just go and watch Lin-Manuel's Hamilton, and you will find, I'd fit just fine in that play, being for independence for Puerto Rico. Because they were all independentistas. I mean, I never quite understood how I could be a radical for wanting independence for Puerto Rico when we celebrate the 4th of July in the United States of America. I never understood it. I even had a great Irish friend, Patrick Kennedy. He came up to me one day and he said, oh, you know, Luis, you should be for statehood for Puerto Rico. And I said, why? He says, because they're all citizens of the United States. And I asked him a question. I said, in Northern Ireland, are there any Irish in Northern Ireland, since they're all subjects of the Queen? And he said, certainly there are Irish. That's my point. Don't confuse citizenship with nationality, okay? Those things have to be unraveled and unwoven in a systematic way, or otherwise you confuse one thing with the other. So what Puerto Rico needs right now is to be put on its feet. Look, you want Puerto Rico to be a state? You want it to be a state? You better, when it asks for admission, that it be in the strongest economic, most viable strength possible. It'll never become a state. You want it to be independent? Then you better make it strong and economically feasible for it to become. All of the options rely on one thing, right? A strong economic footing in which, what's the most important thing? Jobs, right? Economy and jobs and employment that give people a certain and secure future.
Okay, this is from City Club member Martha Janto, who's going to be down in the area of Puerto Rico in the next week or so. Per news reports, the U.S. Navy ship Comfort is not being used very much. Why, when there's apparently such great need?
You know, it's part of the tragedy of Puerto Rico. First, the governor of Puerto Rico, just so everybody, when he was offered the Comfort, said he didn't want it. I think there's a real dilemma in Puerto Rico. You know, you have a young governor, Rosselló. He's 38 years old. He's the biggest thing he's run is a classroom as a school teacher. It's a good thing. I was a school teacher. Nice beginning. But it's very different, a group of students in your classroom and running a whole country, especially when you confront a once-in-a-lifetime kind of situation, which is Hurricane Maria, right? Last time Puerto Rico got hit this hard, it was 90 years ago. Nobody even remembers what it was like 90 years ago in Puerto Rico. But this time, and we didn't have the kind of reliance that we have today on electricity. Now, so I want to say to him, I don't know why. I suspect it is very hard for the governor of Puerto Rico to preach assimilation and integration of Puerto Rico into the United States as the 51st state, and at the same time criticize the United States as being unfair and discriminatory in its practices against the island. But that's his contradiction, not mine. And so I understand why he might be more careful about what he says, especially in dealing with Donald Trump. He may not want to piss him off, because we have seen what happens when you anger this president. So, but I don't have those limitations that he has. I'm going to speak the truth about Puerto Rico. I do want to add this. There, one of the wonderful things is kids now have learned how to play hide and seek. Kids now have learned how to play checkers with one another. And chess, if there's one thing you don't find in the stores, is board games in Puerto Rico. Because I will tell you, an amazing thing does happen when you take away all these electronics away from everybody and they no longer become available to people. Guess what? There is a humanization that occurs. There is a connectivity that those games and the folks at Apple and the folks at Google could never. Human connectedness, something that we should all think about as we move forward.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. This is from my wife, Myrna. Good.
Get her in.
Absolutely. I'll be in trouble.
Happy.
I just want to be able to go home. The question is, because of Maria, will we see an influx of people from Puerto Rico into areas like Florida? And what effect might this have on the balance of political power?
Yes. So the latest estimate last week was 70,000 new residents of Florida from Puerto Rico. That's just Chicago, I don't know how many thousands, but it's thousands of new residents from Puerto Rico in the city of Chicago. How do I know that? There are two flights, one on American, one on United. They come jam-packed without an empty seat, and they come mostly, almost all exclusively, with people fleeing the island of Puerto Rico to the arms of their loved ones. Yesterday, a woman got off the United flight and was put on an ambulance immediately to Cook County Hospital. She's diabetic and had been without insulin. So I tell you to show you the gravity of the problem. You know when governors always say, evacuate, right? That's the most important thing. Get the hell out of trouble's way. There was no place for people of Puerto Rico to evacuate. But there was also no plan, if you knew people couldn't evacuate, to what you do for them differently than anywhere else in the United States of America. So I would just say that they're coming off. Here's the other thing I do want to say. So don't anybody quote me, although I know this is going live, so there are people looking at this and Googling it as I speak. But I think Barack Obama won Florida the second time by less than 50,000 votes. I think. Anybody remember? You can Google that. You know, if you do it now, you can tell me in another 30 seconds what he won by. But I don't think he won by that much. And I don't think Donald Trump won by that much Florida. And in the Electoral College, since that's the way we do things, if you flip Florida, and let me just suggest to everybody, I'm not saying that every Puerto Rican's a Democrat. I'm just saying damn most of them are Democrats. You have a real problem because I don't believe the 70,000 is the end. Unfortunately, I believe that because of the way things are going, hundreds of thousands of people will eventually flee. It's the logical thing to do. What is your first primary instinct as a human being? Survival. You're going to get out. As the tickets become available, as people begin to communicate, you will see more. And listen, they're not coming to Chicago, okay? Wonderful city. I love it. It's my city. Number one city in America, Chicago. I want that on the record through the camera. I don't want anybody. But having said that, I mean, you know, you got Disney World, you got the, it's warmer down there. And they're not going to come. So last time I checked, I had 60,000 Puerto Ricans left in the 4th Congressional District. Why did I say left? Because I remember when it was like 140,000. The fact is, fewer and fewer Puerto Ricans in the city of Chicago. There's a logical reason for that, because they're all moving. Florida now, last fact, Florida now has more Puerto Ricans than New York, yes? Than where you get the famous West Side Story. And it has more Puerto Ricans born on the island of Puerto Rico. My friend Darian Soto, his congressional district, has more Puerto Ricans born on the island of Puerto Rico than any other Latino elected official in the United States. So it kind of tells you the kind of dramatic effect.
Congressman, speaking of a West Side Story, you know that it could not have been written by someone who was Hispanic, because you cannot walk into your district and look up to any of the windows in the buildings and ask for Maria and have only one window open.
But more importantly than that, we knew a Puerto Rican didn't write it, because we would have had the white gym shoes, not the black gym shoes. We would have been the Jets, modern, right? Not some sharks that you build a scary movie around, right? I mean, let's face it, I would have written it very, very differently.
Well, go see Ocasio, and he'll help you rewrite the script. Okay. Couple things before we adjourn. First of all, let's give the congressman a huge round of applause.